All right, we're ready for Mark chapter 9. This is our outline of Mark chapter 9, Mark, the Gospel of Mark. We are in the third section from Galilee to Judea. We made a turning point, transition point last week in chapter 8, as now the focal point is headed toward Jerusalem. More about that in chapter 9. Here's an expansion of that section. We're dealing with the final events and the teaching in Galilee before he heads out toward Judea and Jerusalem. And that'll get us through chapter 9 and in verse 50 here in just a moment. The next week we start into the next section of Jesus comes to the borders of Judea. So we're still in Galilee, but he's got his mind focused and headed toward Jerusalem and the events of Jerusalem. More about that all through chapter 9. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1 is what? The beginning of the Galilean ministry. Chapter 2. All right. Remember, Mark is this fast-paced writer. He quickly gets to that conflict that Matthew took a little while to get to. Chapter 3. Yeah, more of that controversy over the Sabbath healing. Then chapter 4, parables. Matthew 13 kind of gave you a parallel of the how long it took Matthew to get to this point. Chapter 5, three miracles. Chapter 6, all right, more miracles and beheading of John. Chapter 14, by the way, of Matthew, before Matthew got to that. Chapter 7, eating with unwashed hands and miracles. Good. Chapter 8, Matthew 16, that's how long it took Matthew to get to that point. I'm just trying to demonstrate how quickly and how fast-paced Mark is in his writings. All right, chapter 9, in answer to question 1, the main point and the main thrust of chapter 9 has to do with the transfiguration and relationships. But I want to add this note to that, and perhaps the title could be our subtitle, or we could make some other changes to our title of the chapter to reflect this. Remember in chapter 8, if you were here last time, you may have made this note that while chapter 8 dealt with Peter's confession and discipleship, as a backdrop to that, we painted the picture that the chapter does. Mark is painting a picture of the dullness of the disciples, their lack of understanding, their lack of faith. Remember that? We painted several pictures of that. Did you not remember the 5,000, did 4,000, and how is it you don't understand? Remember those statements? This is a continuation of that thought. So in chapter 9, we're still dealing with the dullness of the disciples and their lack of faith. Do they have faith? Yes. Is it what it should be? No. Do they have complete understanding? No. Is their mind focused in the wrong direction? Yes. And I want to give you six or seven evidences of that as we go through the chapter. And we'll flag those as we go along. So we start with the transfiguration, verses 1 to 13. And then we have the healing of the epileptic son. And what's the relation? Well, they one followed the other. But I think it's also the story that we see it laced in each of those, the lack of understanding, or as we've been calling it, dullness of the disciples. Everything in the chapter relates to that, I think. Then we have Jesus foretelling of his death and resurrection. They didn't understand. And then Jesus deals with relationships. Matthew 18 is the parallel. Again, give you that concept. We're in chapter 9, chapter 18, how long it took Matthew to get there. Mark got there real quick. All right, let's get underway now in chapter 9, verses 1 to 13. We've tried to flag the parallel accounts. John doesn't give us any parallel in any of the story today. So we're not concerned with John. But we do have something in Matthew and in Luke most of the time. And when we get toward the end, only Matthew, and then the last two verses, only Mark is the only place that's mentioned. And that's questionable by some. And you say, what do you mean by that? Well, just hang on. We'll get there maybe to verses 49 and 50. It's a textual issue we may talk about. All right, now let's talk about the location of the event of the transfiguration. You may have notes in Matthew 17 when we came through that. There's three places that have been mentioned. The Mount Tabor is the traditional site, so that if you you read most materials, it's going to say something about Mount Tabor. Many think that it's either at Mount Hermon up here close to Caesarea Philippi because that's where the confession was made. Well, that makes sense. Others think that it was more right here in this, which is not on a lot of maps, but Mount Moron is thought to be the place. Jabel Jermak or Mount Moron is where many think that it was, but in one of those two locations is where the transfiguration took place. So why do they think that? Well, one of the reasons is Jesus has just been in Caesarea Philippi. That was in close proximity. But when he comes down off the mount, he's coming down into Galilee, is where the next event takes place concerning this healing of the epileptic son. So some think the latter is the case. Whatever, I'm not sure. One of those two locations is where this takes place. Now let's work through the transfiguration. What does the word transfigure mean? Means to change to another form. The word that is translated transfigure here is the word metamorphosis. Makes sense to you? It means to change to another form. So Jesus is transformed before them. This is not just an exciting event. There is a point to be made. And we'll flag the points as we go along. Now, I want to start though with verse 1. It's interesting that Matthew's account, this is not Matthew, this is translators, took what is in verse 1 and shoved it into the previous chapter where it fits. And the translators put Mark 1, 9 and 1 with Mark 9 instead of shoving it with the previous chapter. Be that as it may, it starts off on this, it just makes the point that there's some standing here will not taste of death till the kingdom of God is present or comes with power. I learned two things from that, that the people then living would see the kingdom be established. Thus goes premillennialism. Secondly, I learn that when it comes with power. Power would come with the Holy Spirit. Acts 1 in verse 8, the Holy Spirit came on the day of Pentecost, which then tying those prophecies together, the kingdom is established on Pentecost. Make sense? So tie those verses together and see if that makes sense to you. That's part of the discussion, verse 1, with this at the end of them focusing their mind on the things of the earth and not on the things of God. The value of the kingdom has to do with that. Now, who goes with him on this to the Mount of Transfiguration? Peter, James, and John, that inner circle of disciples to whom he was closer and went up on a high mountain. He was transfigured before them, and his clothes became shining like snow, like no laundry could whiten them. And who appears? Elijah and Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. Do we know what they were talking about? Well, Luke tells us about that. So let's go and take a look at Luke. There is the value of parallel accounts. So let's go over to Luke chapter 9. And this is going to help us a little bit. Luke 9 and verse 30. Without reading the verse, my pages are sticking together. If you see that, tell me what you see in verse 30 and 31. Verse 31. They spoke about his decease, which is his death, and the things that he would accomplish at Jerusalem. That's the focal point, remember? Mindset toward Jerusalem. Now, Matthew doesn't tell us that. Mark doesn't tell us that. Luke gives us some insight what the discussion was about. So he's transfigured, and they see Jesus transfigured before them. They see Moses and Elijah, and they're having a discussion. What are they talking about? The death of Jesus and what's going to take place at Jerusalem. Do you think the disciples understand? Nah, they don't get it. And we probably wouldn't have either. Then Peter made his proposal. What did he propose? Let's build a tabernacle, three tabernacles, one for each of you. Now look at verse 6, you might underline this, because he did not know what to say. That didn't keep him from saying something. Do you know anybody that's like that? They don't know what to say, but they're going to say something anyway. That was Peter. He didn't know what to say. He didn't know how to react to this, but I'm going to say something. That's an interesting point. For they were greatly afraid. They didn't know what to say. And so a cloud overshadowed them, and then the voice from heaven said what? This is my beloved son, hear him. We're going to come back and make a point about that. And then they looked around, and there's no one but Jesus only. And when they came down from the mountain, he told them not to tell anyone anything till the Son of Man has risen from the dead. You might flag John 7, verses 6 and verse 8 as part of an explanation of that. That is, that's when full declaration can be made. So don't be telling, because full declaration will not be understood until there is the resurrection. Now we fully can proclaim and people will understand. Now, verse 10, I'm trying to get down to the end of this, and then we're going to make some sense of all of this. That they ask about the coming of Elijah. And what they're talking about is Malachi 4. There was a prophecy of Elijah coming, and that was a prophecy fulfilled in John the Baptist. Very good. Luke chapter 1, verse 17. So Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6 was the prophecy fulfilled in John, Luke 1 and 17. And so they ask, well, we saw Elijah. What's this prophecy about Elijah? Well, he did come, and he is coming, or he did come, and he suffered. And I'm paraphrasing verse 12 and 13, but that the things concerning the Son of Man must also be fulfilled, which has to do with his suffering. So now let's go back and learn some things from this. We have question number two. Where in the New Testament is this discussed in detail besides Matthew, Mark, and Luke? It's an epistle. It was written by Peter, so that's going to limit you. 2 Peter 1, beginning at verse 16. And it's used there to establish their faith, that our faith is not based upon fables, but our faith is based upon evidence. Want evidence? The transfiguration. All right, now what do we learn from this story of the transfiguration? It affirms the deity of Christ. It argues for the resurrection. But more importantly, it says to the disciples who Jesus is, who are dull of their understanding. That's the context. It says to the disciples who Jesus is. We have Moses representing the law and Elijah representing the prophets, and we have the law and the prophets giving testimony of who Jesus is and what he would do, and when the cloud disappears, there's only Jesus, meaning he's the only one left, yes. So there is the superiority of Christ and his dispensation over the law and the prophets. Make sense? The disciples need to see that. And so when he said, "This is my beloved son, hear him," it's not merely listen to him and listen to the prophets and listen, but hear him over the prophets and the law. Does that make sense? Now he's not in contrast to the prophets and the law. That's not the point. But that when his dispensation is fulfilled, that is when his kingdom is established, you're listening to him rather than the law and the prophets. That makes sense? He's superior to the law and the prophets. Now, let's go back to this dullness. I said that I'd list seven things. I don't have them on the screen. So if you want to list these, I'm not going to give them all at one time, but we'll try to list them all before we get through it. So we're addressing the dullness of the disciples. The Transfiguration suggests tells us they should have stronger faith. They don't understand what's going on. So the transfiguration is for the purpose of strengthening their faith in Jesus. Does that make sense? So does it help me? Sure. But it was really for the disciples to understand you're dull and you're not getting who Jesus is. He is superior to the law and the prophets. He's deity. Does that make sense? This is the Son of God. They heard God himself say that. All right? Now, let's go to the next story. In the next story here, I was right there and then took off. Let's talk about the healing of the epileptic son, verses 14 to 29. And we have parallel accounts in Matthew and in Luke. We'll flag those as we need to. But let's talk about this healing of the epileptic son. Now, let's go back to our list of seven things about the dullness of the disciples, if you're making that list. Here's what I'm learning from this context. I'm learning about how the disciples fail because of their lack of faith from this story. See the painting of the picture of the dullness of the disciples? They failed here for their lack of faith. Here's a third thing I'm going to learn from this in the dullness, and that is the man who believed needed help with his faith. That demonstrates the disciples who believed, but they still needed, finish my sentence, help with their faith. Verse 24. Make sense? All right. Now we'll come back to that list of seven things. Jesus comes down off the mountain, and what does he find when he comes off the mountain? Yeah, there's a great multitude, and the scribes are disputing with the disciples. And Jesus comes and asks, what are y'all discussing? Do you think he didn't know? No, he wants to draw something out. He does know. And so one of them said, I brought my son, who had a mute spirit. And let me tell you how bad it is. Verse 18, it seizes him, throws him down, he foams at the mouth, gnashes at the teeth, becomes rigid. And I spoke to your disciples, but they could not cast him out. That they should cast him out, but they could not. His faith took a hit because of the disappointment he had in the disciples. There's a practical lesson there. Could my reaction, could my lack of faith put a hit in someone's faith when they're trying to come to the Lord? Does that make sense? See, they're trying to come to the Lord, and I talk to your disciples, and they couldn't do this. It put a little doubt in his mind. Let's get ahead of ourselves. Look at verse 22. If you can do anything. My behavior, my action, my lack of action, my lack of faith may put a hit in someone else's faith. Think about that. So Jesus answered and said, O faithless generation. He's talking about the Jews. He's talking to the scribes. You faithless generation. Flag that verse. We'll make some use of that in a moment. Faithless generation, how long will I bear with you? And so bring him to me. Jesus seems to be exasperated. So what does he do now? Brought him to him. It's obvious that the son has got problems because he convulsed and he fell on the ground and he wallowed foaming at the mouth. And he asked the father, how long has this been going on? Well, since childhood. He's often thrown both in the fire. And notice, he said, if you can do anything, have compassion and help us. If you can do anything. Where'd that doubt come from? Maybe because of dealing with the disciples. Yeah, he's lacking something there, isn't he? And Jesus said, if you can believe, all things are possible. Now let's get to verse 24, because this gets to the point. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said in tears, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. The New International renders that, help me overcome my unbelief. He claims to have faith. But he recognizes his weakness. Do you think Jesus is using this story to demonstrate to the disciples, yes, you have faith, but you're like this man who needs help overcoming his unbelief? See, that could apply to me and you. It's not a matter of you either have faith or you don't have faith. You can have faith, and yet you still have a problem of needing to overcome some unbelief. Does that make sense? And so you say, well, I'm a believer. Well, good. So were the disciples. The disciples were believers. And so was this man. But he said, help my unbelief. We're going to flag some more things about him. Let's finish the story and go back to our list of seven, and then we're going to make a separate list of three. So when Jesus saw the people come running, what did he do? He rebuked the unclean spirit, came out of him. He fell down. The people said, well, he's dead now. Look at verse 26. But Jesus lifted him up. And so then the disciples privately wanted to know, why couldn't we do that? And Jesus said, this kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting. Now, you may have some notes over at Matthew 17. You can look back to see if you do. If not, then you can make some notes there or elsewhere. What does that refer to? This kind suggests to me, and you may disagree, fine, but I think it suggests that there are different types or varying degrees or varying strengths of demons. There's something about this kind. This one is strong enough that it only comes out by prayer and fasting. I think the point, Linsky captured part of the point by saying that faith must be stimulated by prayer and fasting. Poole said, there are some things that are obtained by a stronger faith. In other words, just having some faith is not going to get this. It's not going to cut it here. He's telling the disciples. Jesus talking, just having faith is not going to cut it. You need to have the kind of faith, the degree of faith, the strength of faith that you don't have, but you need the kind of strength of faith that comes by the kind of action of praying and fasting where you're focused in fasting on the things of God and not the things of men. Sound familiar? Context, chapter 8. Make sense? I think he's lacing that with what he had just said in our last week's study. That wasn't a week ago in the context. That was just a moment ago in the context. You're minding the things of men and not the things of God. You don't have enough faith. Your faith isn't strong enough to do this. And this is the kind of faith that comes by focused on God and not on the things of men like you're focused on. Does that make sense? Yes, ma'am. That's a textual issue. Maybe so, because their faith gave what focal point they have here soon gives way to this, whatever right focal point they have gives way to focused on themselves again. And so I think that there's some validity to that. Now, this story is a story of faith and doubt. Now, we're coming back to our list of seven things we gave a moment ago. I'm fixing to give you a list of three things in this context. That this is a story of faith and doubt. There's a general statement at verse 19 of the faithless Jews. Verse 22, there's the father who expressed his doubt, if you can do anything. And then the disciples failed because of a lack of faith. Verse 29. Make sense? So what's this story about? It's about faith and doubt. The overall theme? The dullness, lack of faith of the disciples. So now let's go back to our list of seven things here. We've already listed, I think, if you didn't get those, that they failed, number two, for the lack of faith. And number three, they did not I'll get to that in a moment. Verse three, that the man who believed demonstrates that he has faith, but he needs more help with his faith like the disciples. So we've got three in our list of seven. We're about to get number four in the next section. All right, let's go now to the next section, which is 30 to 32. And this takes place where? In Galilee. So wherever he was, whether it's up here in Caesarea Philippi, as we had him a moment ago, maybe, or maybe closer to the northern part of Galilee, he comes down into Galilee and he did not want anyone to know it. And he talks to his disciples. And what does he say to them? Yeah, has he said this before? Yeah, he said this before, but they're not understanding. And so notice now, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. And after they killed him, they'll rise the third day. They don't fully understand that. How do I know? Well, look at verse 32. But they did not understand this saying, and they were afraid to ask him. Now, that deserves some comment. First of all, let's add something Matthew tells us that Mark doesn't tell us. Matthew tells us in Matthew 17, 23, that when he said this, they were sorrowful. They understood what it meant. They didn't understand how it applied, if that makes sense. They didn't understand anything about it. Why were they sorrowful? They understood that he was saying, I'm going to be killed. They didn't like that. So they were sorrowful. That sorrow soon gives away to focused on themselves again. You say, well, where does that happen? In verse 33, next verse. All right. But here's another thing. Let's go back to chapter. It says they were afraid to ask him anything. Peter was afraid to ask. Are you kidding me? Go back to chapter 8, verse 33. Do I know for sure this is the reason? No, but this is the last thing that's happened with Peter. When Peter rebuked the Lord, remember verse 31, he told him he's going to suffer and be rejected and killed. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. So that's not going to happen. And the Lord rebuked Peter, saying, get you behind me, Satan, for you're not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. So he tells them again, I'm going to be killed. And they're afraid to ask. Reckon why? I would be too. Peter got rebuked pretty severely when he showed he didn't understand what was going on. I'm not saying that was Jesus' fault. That was Peter's fault. Is whose fault that was. Make sense? Now, what did I learn from 30 to 32? They did not understand the announcement. This is our list of seven. This is number four of the seven, if you're keeping up with that. We're painting a picture in this chapter of the dullness of the disciples. They did not understand the announcement of the death and resurrection. Do you see how this is typical of all gospel writers by Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John? But that they're telling stories to paint a picture. It's not just, oh, here's another story we want to tell about Jesus. Oh, and here's another interesting story. It's like you would, if you wanted to talk about somebody's dishonesty, say, and prove it, you might tell they were dishonest here, and you tell another story where they were dishonest, but you may have details of a colorful story, but your purpose in lacing the stories together is to, you're putting a theme together. That's what Mark's doing. This is dullness of the disciples in chapter 9. Make sense? All right. Let's go to the next section, which has to do with relationships now. And this is parallel to Matthew 18. The relationships, this is not my statement I'm about to make is not critical of Matthew or Mark or inspiration, but the relationships come through clearer to me. The focal point on relationships come through clearer in Matthew 18. Mark may have a different vantage point of telling the same story, and perhaps so. With that said, he focuses on relationships. Now let's start with the question of who is the greatest. Now they came to Capernaum. Now that's in the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, which is right here in the middle part. You see Capernaum right there, that middle dot. So wherever they were coming off of the mountain, this discussion about the epileptic son and then the disciples' discussion about the death and resurrection had to take place in that northern part of Galilee, and then he came to Capernaum. Let me back up. So the question, Mark adds something that we don't see elsewhere. Mark said they had been disputing on the road. Matthew doesn't tell us that. Luke doesn't tell us that. They had been disputing on the road, and Matthew paints it in a different light. It's not contradictory, but Matthew said they ask him who is the greatest. So you put the two accounts together, I take it that what was going on, they were disputing and arguing over who is the greatest. And when Jesus calls them and said, well, now what were y'all disputing about? He knew, but he wants them to tell me. So, well, we were arguing about who is the greatest, and so you answer that for us, Jesus, who is the greatest in the kingdom. Now, that question is not a question of who is most important in the kingdom and who is the greatest, but it is a concept of a, what kind of kingdom? Earthly kingdom. And it's talking about who is the most prominent. Matthew 20 gives us some insight to that. Can my son sit on your right hand and on your left? And I've illustrated it many times. If you were in politics and you were high in politics and your good friend is being elected to president, what are you probably thinking? I'm going to get maybe a cabinet position. Which one will I get? I want state. That's the most coveted of all. Or maybe defense. Nobody wants Secretary of Interior. Nobody wants out there Secretary of Education. Nobody wants that. You want to be State or Defense or Chief of Staff and run the country. You want some prominent position. And so the idea is, who's going to sit on the right hand? Who's going to sit on the left? Who is the most influential in the kingdom? That's the question. Does that make sense? All right. And so one of the things we're seeing is they do not understand the nature of the kingdom. So let's go ahead and go back to our list of seven things, beginning at verse 33. They're focused on the wrong thing. They're focused on prominent positions rather than humility. That demonstrates the dullness of the disciples. They didn't understand the nature of the kingdom. And so Jesus, what does he do? Calls a child in their midst and puts him before them, and I'm harmonizing Matthew's account and this account, tells him you need to be humble as a child. And if you're not humble as a child, you're not even into the kingdom. In other words, if you don't change your attitude, if you don't get over this dullness, you don't get over this understanding, you won't even be in the kingdom, let alone have high places in it. And then he says, whoever receives one of these little ones in my name, this is an expression of humility, verse 37, receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but one who sent me. In other words, you need to be humble as a child in order to be accepted of God and accepted of His Son and of the Father. Make sense? Oh, go ahead. Oh, yeah. They good point. Yeah, verse 34, they were silent, for they had disputed on the road about who's the greatest among themselves. In other words, I hate to tell you, but I was arguing, thinking I was going to get right hand in the kingdom. And Peter over there thought he would get it. That's embarrassing. Which one of us is the most needed? All right, now let's take the next section, which is don't reject one who works in Christ's name. And so we had a question on that. Let's get the text first, and then we'll come back to our question. Just don't want to forget the question. John said, there's one that's following us that cast out demons in your name, but we forbid him because he does not follow. In other words, he's not with us. He's not traveling with us, in other words. And Jesus' answer to that was, don't stop him. He's working in my name. Let's go to question number, question number 8. That is used to justify denominationalism. There's Christians in all denominations is the idea. So how would you respond to that argument? All right. It doesn't tell us he's following false teaching or false doctrine or advocating false doctrine. He's just not with the disciples in locality. Yeah, let's take a look right here. Three things. You might make this in the margin of your text in case a friend of yours says, hey, there's denominations and there's Christians in all denominations. If this passage applies to people in denominationalism, it justifies them staying in denominationalism. Because Jesus basically said he's fine, didn't he? So if this is talking about someone who's practicing error, and that's okay, then let him stay in error and let him practice error. Secondly, Jesus approved of this man. So he's not a false teacher. He didn't approve of the false teacher. Matthew 7. He was simply unknown to John and not working with the apostles. Do you think it's possible there's some Christian that you don't know somewhere that's not in your immediate circle of people you know? Well, certainly. And if they're following the Lord, they're following the Lord. That's the question. And so that's what Jesus is talking about. So what does this have to do with the context? Let's go back to our text here. That in this nature of the kingdom, Jesus talked about receiving this humility they needed, would receive one another. And now the story about John. Well, here was one that came and we didn't receive him. And rightfully so, right, Jesus? No. You should have received him. So it's in that context. All right, let's go to the next section. Jesus warns about offense, offending others. Your translation may say at verse 42, whoever, if you make one of these little ones in me to offend, or it may say to stumble. The New King James will say, literally, your footnote will say that means to fall into sin. That does not mean offense where you don't like what somebody did or said, but you caused them to sin. Now, what's the problem with causing someone to sin? If you lead someone into sin, what happens? Yeah, better that a millstone hung around his neck and that he would drown in the depths of the sea. Now notice three times, verse 44, verse 46, verse 48, Jesus talks about being cast into hell. Verse 43, the word hell is Gehenna, the eternal abode of the wicked. It says, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. It alludes to the normal practice of things, and things are different. How so? Well, the worm will eat the flesh of the animal, and when the flesh is consumed, the worm normally or typically dies. You burn trash, and the trash is burned. When it's consumed, the fire goes out. But he said the worm doesn't die, and the fire is not quenched in hell. In other words, the expression means it does not end. Eternal hell. Now, Homer Haley and some others argued, Ed Fudge and others have written, so when I quote them, I'm quoting from books they've published and I've read, and you can read them too, where they argued that hell lasts for a little while and then it goes, you go out of existence, annihilation. This passage says hell does not end. The fire is not quenched. And the worm does not die. Now, we've got to get to the most difficult verses in 49 and 50. Two problems here. We have no parallel account. Mark is the only one that mentions this. So this is the only information we're going to find is right here, as far as any parallel. Secondly, there is a textual issue. So as you read the verses, I read some stuff and from these verses, you say it's missing from mine. Your translation is based on the minority text. Mine is based on the majority text. We've talked about that many times. Texas Receptus majority, or the Nestle's United Bible Society, or Westcott Hort minority text. All right. Now that gets into textual criticism. Let's just assume it's all there, which it may not be. Linsky says there's not good, strong favor for it, but let's just assume it's there. There's no error taught. That I've labeled here, be a salt and have peace. And Bible Knowledge Commentary said he came up with 15 different interpretations he had found on these two verses. They're extremely difficult. Linsky said it's not that difficult, it's pretty simple. And then he gave three or four different explanations of that. So anyway, let's make a stab at this. For everyone shall be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice seasoned with salt. What's that talking about? My first answer I know is correct. I don't know for sure. But I do think the term fire has some connection with fire that has just been mentioned starting at verse 42. Either in contrast or in connection, I'm not sure. So what's the point? I'm going to have to quickly get to this because our time is going out. The point may be that all of us are subject to judgment to come, the fire that destroys. So what you need is salt to preserve you from that corruption. And so the point may be the lack of faith of the disciples is endangering them. Linsky argues, it's in contrast, that instead of losing your life, your soul by fire, it is to be preserved by fiery trials. Stouffer argues that it's the salt of the Word. The Word is used as a salt to preserve you, and while it burns, sometimes the Word does burn, it will stay the rot of corruption in your life. But whatever he's talking about, here's the conclusion, have peace among yourselves. So let's do one more thing and we'll be done. They need to have stronger faith. These disciples need to have stronger faith to hold to Christ. And so what he's telling them is when you do have faith, you will have peace. Go back to the dispute, verse 33, they were arguing among themselves. Does that make sense? So our list of seven things, let's get number six and number seven. Number six is they could lead others into sin, verse 42 and following, with this lack of faith, and they could endanger their soul, verse 49 and 50. So seven descriptions of the dullness of the disciples. That's what I wanted you to see. We're going to stop right there.